Do you sometimes feel that micromobility doesn't quite live up to its potential? Going back a few years, 2017, 18, 19, e-bikes, e-scooters, there was this sense of transformational potential for urban mobility. All of us able to zip around town on individualized, shared devices, connecting everywhere to anywhere. And some of that's happening. You know, we see the growth of Lime and Forest in cities like London. But in terms of changing the dynamic of the way our cities work, it hasn't quite made it yet. So why? Is there more potential, or is this as good as it gets? Well, Tom Nutley of Urban Sharing thinks there is more potential, but the industry needs to change how it operates. And on today's episode, he tells me why. Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling podcast. I'm joined today by Tom Nutley of Urban Sharing, whose personal mission, at least according to LinkedIn, is to make micromobility profitable. But does that mean it's working or failing as a force for good? Let's get into the business model, the social promise, the funding roller coaster, and whether micromobility can survive, thrive in a car-shaped world. Tom Nutley, welcome to the Freewheeling podcast.
Thank you, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be here.
So a year ago, I was working for Transport for London. I live in Walthamstow in East London. Their HQ is in Southwark. So I had two options for going to work, which I roughly alternated. I could either get the Victoria Line to St Pancras and then Thames Link, or I could get the Overground to Liverpool Street and then get a shared e-bike from Liverpool Street to Southwark. And I did that about half the time. And it was fantastic. Yeah, in every way, that was a brilliant way to start the day. It was fun. It was enjoyable. A small amount of exercise. Unbelievably fast. Really good. But that journey took me across the City of London and Southwark, which are probably two of the most bike-friendly, active travel-friendly, human-friendly boroughs in the entirety of the United Kingdom. So does this actually work for the world that we have built and are continuing to build at a national, global scale? Question.
Good question, and a hard one to start. I appreciate that.
I know,
that.
I thought I'd just dive straight in. I didn't think there's any point starting with the easy stuff.
The reality is no. You know, it's quite clear that transport dead spots are very much a growing concern and one that exists even in large-scale cities such as London. And, you know, this is part of the problem, that all the investment, all of the, I guess, additional transport modes, whether they be public or private, are always launched in kind of the epicenter of a city. You live in London, you have access to the tube, you have access to the buses, you have access to bikes, you have access to scooters, you have access to e-bikes, you name it, you can access it. And the problem is the further you go out from that kind of center, the less is available. Whereas the reality is that's kind of quite critical, whether it's kind of what you were saying in terms of getting to a transport location to getting to London, whether that be by, which is traditionally by car, or it's getting to a location in London and then cycling. The reality is infrastructure is nowhere near it needs to be in the UK. You know, when we're sitting there spending, I don't know how much it will got to now, 60, 70, 80, 100 billion on HS2, which has been a monumental failure. What that could have done for active travel infrastructure, not only in kind of our major cities, but also our smaller towns, would have been profound. That then has a knock-on effect to usage, because one of the largest impacts of whether people will cycle or use micromobility is safety. And infrastructure, you know, you do not want to necessarily be cycling or on a scooter next to an LGV. It's not a comfortable experience, even when you're driving on the motorway and it's moving lanes, let alone when you're on a bike.
So tell me a bit about you and where you've come from in this world, because you used to be part of an operator. You're not anymore. What's your journey been that's given you the perspective you've got on this sector?
Yeah, good. So I'm not a cyclist. I am now. I never was a cyclist. I played rugby was fortunate enough to be offered a role following a number of roles in the tech sales space with a bike sharing company that had an AI tool that moved supply to meet demand based upon a number of, I guess, historic and latent conditions, where the research project was delivered in the London Cycle Hire system. That was 9 years ago. And I guess from then, the first kind of 2-3 years was very much falling in love with the industry. Then following COVID, where I took a kind of a short hiatus, shall we say, which a number of people do in micromobility outside of it, realized this is really what I want to be doing and I'd love to come back to it. At that point, there was a level of frustration that not much had changed. You know, we were still beating the same drum. We were still saying the same things were needed, but no one was actually doing anything about it. And I guess that's where more of the personal mission of kind of how do we challenge the status quo, both at operator level and at city level, to really the movement. That movement could be a number of form factors, whether it's legislative shift, whether it's financing or funding, to really drive this industry forward. Because if we don't, you know, the impact's too high. You know, I'll give you an example. You know, that the government are happy to spend, I can't remember the actual figure, but it's hundreds of millions on carbon capture technology, which isn't proven. But the active travel, you know, the investment in bikes was minuscule. You know, we're looking at the problem the wrong way.
Did you just say you used to play rugby for a living? How long for? Doing what? For whom?
Yeah.
You just can't just drop that in as a few words and then move on.
No, I mean, I played semi-professionally. So I worked on the side. I played at Cambridge and a number of clubs in the second and third tier. I guess even more exciting information, I'm an identical twin and my brother actually played for Northampton in the Premiership. So he took the rugby prowess and I moved forward on kind of the business prowess side over the last 10 years. But yeah, primarily in Cambridge was where I played most of my time.
This is absolutely fascinating because this is the second time I've encountered this phenomenon. So I used to have a colleague, he and his brother were both avid rugby players as kids. He decided to go into the business world. His brother stayed in rugby. His brother became a Welsh international.
Yeah.
So this, I mean, I've got to ask you the question. Do you regret not having chased the rugby dream given what your brother achieved?
No, because it's, you know, it's almost like the Gartner hype cycle. You kind of hit a point in your career and then fall off quite dramatically. And that's kind of how your earnings will go unless you are the top, you know, 2% of rugby players, and then you get a pundit's role or whatever it might be. So from a longevity perspective, no. And also kind of, you know, now I've got kids where the state that my body and also my mind are in versus having continued to play at that level for another 5 years, I'm quite happy that I called it when I did.
And then here's the key question. Does your brother regret his choices?
Good question. I don't think he regrets going into rugby at all. I think he regrets some of the decisions he made throughout his career, but not necessarily picking that one as a career.
Fantastic. That is, by the way, exactly what the other set of brothers said. They both were totally convinced that they had made the right decision, which is fantastic and a validation that we all generally convince ourselves that we've made the right choices in life, which is probably a good thing. But you're not convinced that the micromobility industry has made all the right choices. You mentioned earlier that one of the frustrations when you came back into it was that the same problems existed. And yet this is a sector that has moved faster and changed faster than pretty much any other. Do you want to just quickly paint a picture of what you think should be possible? What's the potential of this sector in your view, if we get it right?
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, there needs some context there, right? Like micromobility is a term that was only coined 6 years ago in 2019 by Horace Diddew. Apologies if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly.
And if anyone wants to hear, he's a previous guest on this podcast talking about why he came up with that term. So you can scroll back through the archives and have a listen.
Shameless plug that I didn't know I was making. No, I know. You know, whereas the reality is, shared bikes have been around since 1960, you know, and the funny story is they were launched in Amsterdam. They were painted white. They were a political movement to get rid of the cars. And they ended up exactly the way that every single kind of non-docked bike share has ended, which is it generally in any river that can be found. The interesting thing that you see over kind of that 60 years, so, you know, that was 1960. In the 1990s, the outdoor advertising giants Clear Channel and JCDecaux decided to bring them in, launch those as part of a, you know, a way of winning outdoor advertising projects was the reality. And they launched in, you know, countless cities across the world. We then moved into the US in around early 2000s. London obviously came, which was very much part of Ken Livingston, but fortunately or unfortunately, have been branded Boris Bike. It doesn't matter who seems to sponsor it. They can't seem to shake that kind of notion. Then we kind of, 2015 to 2017, we had the Chinese dockless bike boom. 2 years later, we had the scooter boom. And the reality is we keep making the same mistakes over and over again that we were made all the way back in 1960. You know, private, you know, public-private partnerships are proven to work, whether it's through advertising or if they're treated as, you know, public transport with funding. Oculus, or, you know, Doclus, when I say that, I guess that's, say, free-floating, has a raft of issues and always has done, from vandalism, you know, indiscriminate parking, so on and so forth. So the, I guess, you know, when we look at it, it's kind of, okay, where does the future lie? Well, it lies in what we already know works. You know, as the human race and how we understand how transport works, especially public transport, is we would never expect a bus to just turn up where and when we need it. That's what Uber's for, or a taxi, right? We'd never expect the metro or the tube to suddenly start popping up with new stations just because it's convenient for other people. You go to that location. So I think, you know, what does the future look like? Infrastructure is available to both park and charge any one of those micromobility vehicles, because that increases availability, right? When I, as a user, when I get to a location, I want to make sure there is that I've got, you know, a vehicle available, and available means that it's charged, it's clean, and it's usable. Now, over time, if they are set locations, I start to learn which ones are my preferred and my non-preferred, and what ones always have kind of a peak or flow of charging and infrastructure. The next step is, you know, when we look at it right now, what works very well, especially when you look at the ridership statistics that generally are published by Fluctuo and NABSA and a few of the others, large scale works. If you're going to do it, go big or go home. The reality is small fleets don't work. You do not get the density that you need to make it work. And ultimately, then we see trips per vehicle per day of kind of under one. Large scale systems, especially on the docked bike share public municipal system, we're seeing. The next point is funded. Now, funding, that I mean public funding, this has got to be seen as a public-private partnership entity, because otherwise the cost is doesn't work. Right. If you take a Lime bike, or if you take a scooter, or any, you know, or a Forest, excluding the 10 minutes you get free, you're still looking at, you know, between £4 and £7 for a 2 to 3 mile trip. That's almost not far off what you'll pay in an Uber. You'll get there quicker because the average speed limits in most of these towns are, you know, 7 to 9 miles an hour. And you can obviously go a lot faster on an e-bike, but especially if the infrastructure is in place. But it's also not tenable for the people that need it the most, i.e. low-income workers, can't afford to own a car, can't afford to be paying extreme amounts of money not on public transport. And especially when you take places like London that are incorporating the ULEZ zone and actually making it even more difficult to not own expensive electric cars, it's kind of a critical factor. So TLDR on that, we need infrastructure, physical or non-physical, ideally physical, just at least within the center. And then as we go out into an outer ring, more of a hybrid. And then as we go out into kind of the suburbs and what we would necessarily clarify as transport dead spots, you can move more to the free-floating model because it suits the location. Second point is funding. We need to treat micromobility, shared micromobility, whether it's a private or a public organization, as public transport. That can be through incentives to drive the vehicles out to where they need to be to actually meet those transport dead spots and use micro incentives or however you want to term them, or as a capital combined with an operational fund to make sure that these work well. And the third is always the same. It's integration, right? You know, it's not a case of, you know, a bike cannibalizing a bus trip or a tube trip. It's a case of how do we incorporate the two or make it work based upon the conditions that are available. As you rightly said, I will always prefer to walk or cycle or scoot outside when I'm in London. But then I live in a tiny village where I like being outside. Other people's preferences might be to jump in a car. But what we want to be able to provide is, if one of my preferred options isn't available at that point, i.e. I leave my house, I can grab a bike, I can get to the tube station, I can then get the tube into where I needed to do. And if I want to, I can then maybe get a bike or walk at the other end. We need that integration into the transport modes that make sense, and we need to make sure that we're not, both on the public side, that we're not expecting revenue generation necessarily off that from the operator, and also conversely the operator is not expecting revenue generation or payment from the transport authority or the app provider to be able to utilize their service.
And both of those things have kind of declined in recent years, haven't they? Because if you go back to the period of the, you know, Vélib in Paris, or the Boris bikes, as you rightly identify, they're always called in London. They were integrated. You know, the Boris bikes bear the TfL Randall. They are paid for by the state. There's an operator contracted to deliver the service. And it's a very similar model to the London bus model. Whereas now we're in this world where transport authorities seem to think of them as either a source of revenue, oh great, we can charge these people, or they see them as something that's largely irrelevant to them. What they don't seem to see is that they're part of the transport mix. And presumably that's a big part of that is because the operators aren't asserting that it is. I mean, you know, if you're Lime, you seem to be much more thinking of yourself in the Uber model of being a completely separate transport mode that sits outside the public transport system, that operates independently, ideally with as little regulation as possible, which is very different from the operators of the early dock schemes.
Yeah, and because both of them are at different points of, you know, maturity. The dock schemes, as we said, have got decades and decades of experience. The model's been substantiated. It's still not perfect. And obviously, there's still quite a big difference between the UK, European and US markets on that. The other thing comes in is when you look at kind of the current, your Limes, your Forests, your Tiers, your Dots, the model is different, but it's also all that people see. And this can be event, people that are organizing events. This can be cities, this can be a number of different things, is the number that these companies raised when money was easily raisable. And they think, how do I get a piece of that? That's all people are looking at this, you know, it's a financial grab. I'll give you an example. You know, there was events in Europe and in the US that were charging, you know, those OFO and Mobike that had billions of pounds of funding. And then conversely, you know, your Birds, your Limes, your Tiers, almost 5 to 10 times what they were charging other people just to exhibit at the booth, because in their mind, they had the money.
And at that time they did.
Yeah, of course. And now most of those events have dried up because as of those companies have. And I think that's the problem, is people are kind of forgetting that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? A company is private, has a large amount of capital available to it, whether that's for investment or revenue. Someone tries to take a piece of that, which then impacts, you know, how, whether that's a city or whoever that might be, which then impacts how they're able to operate. Who end up, and this is the end, you know, what really bugs me is who loses out the most? The end user. Because the end user then probably has to pay more to make up for the, you know, one, for the profit share or whatever is agreed with the city or the location. Two, because the operational requirements are increased dramatically because of the, you know, the unfounded SLA or KPIs that are put in by that city. And the actual person that we're trying, you know, the core focus that we're actually trying to improve, which is promoting active travel for the vast majority of the population, loses out. And I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's greed. I don't know whether it's kind of an opportunity. But, you know, we've seen these crazy things where scooter fines are more expensive than a car fine. That, you know, and you kind of sit there and go, okay, well, what's going on here? Why is it being villainized to the point of we're going to put these companies out of business when there is quite evidently a massive, you know, a huge need across multiple cities across Europe and the world where this is in play. So, you know, for me, cities need to understand where they sit in this framework or the, you know, this agreement. Cities aren't revenue generating, they're not businesses. They're public entities that are there for public good. They are, should not be, you know, the same as a charity. It's not about making money. Yes, they need to have money to be able to invest, but this is the concerning thing is that no one's seeing where this money they are requesting or requiring is going. If people saw in a tender or an RFI or whatever it might be that, okay, cool, we're going to do a share, or we're going to expect X amount of payment per vehicle, but all of that capital is going to be put into advocacy, infrastructure investments, so on and so forth, then it's the right form of self-fulfilling prophecy, because then the operators can go, okay, cool, that makes perfect sense, because that's going to engage and amplify how this system would be used. Right now, it's just kind of like, you need to give us this cash because you've had a ton of VC capital and we know you've got it.
The problem that I see and hear having this conversation is I can't work out, other than like you, who's the advocate for doing this right, because you're saying to the cities, you need to think of this as another public transport mode, figure out where it fits into your public transport strategy, contract to deliver the outcomes that you need. And that doesn't mean that it's a revenue source for you, but it means it's a cost for you. And then you're equally turning around to the operators and saying, and you need to be ready to fulfill that social need and not simply to chase down the few places where there's already high demand, but instead to provide a service that delivers against the city's objectives. It probably means a lower margin business, though potentially in far more places. And at the moment, I'm not hearing either of the people you're talking about there actually saying that's what they want to do.
No, because one thing that has always been consistent in this industry is what is public will point the finger at private saying, we, you know, do something, not necessarily, you know, qualifying what that do something is. And the private will point the finger back at the city because, and that's the inherent problem. Why is it me, I guess, or I guess there are others like me, but why me? Because being a third-party software provider, which, you know, to the industry, which I have been over the last 9 years, allows me a level of, I work with all of those entities in some way, shape or form. You know, I work with the riders, I work with the you know, the operators, and we work with the cities. So we hear what everyone says about each other. And all of them are saying a similar thing, concerns and annoyance and problems. But an operator can't say it to a city at the risk of being blackmarked. A city can't say it to an operator with the risk of not feel, and then that's primarily because they feel they don't have enough information, they don't have enough knowledge, and they don't want to be a trendsetter for the wrong reasons, which is why we've always had this copy and paste methodology when it comes to tenders and licenses and RFIs.
And when you say a copy and paste methodology, you basically mean cities repeatedly putting out requests for
the same,
which is largely, that is, you run your service as and where you want it, probably free floating, and you give us a chunk of money in return for doing it.
Yeah.
It's largely unbranded, and it sits outside the core public transport strategy.
Yeah, or in the case of Dog Bike Share, you know, the London cycle hire system's up for retender right now. I think the last two submissions were made 2 weeks ago today. You know, there's also problems on that. Although there's a public, you know, there's a public element of money, there's no OPEX money that's generally provided. It's a concession contract that is a total fee that then whatever you bid, you have to spend that wisely over the term of the agreement. But also we see that the winner is awarded based upon price. Now, we all know you get what you pay for, but we're sort of happy to kind of do that. Would we ever do that when we're talking about the tube, you know, replacing the tube provider or the bus provider? Of course we wouldn't, because the risk is too high. If you come in with a poor, you know, a poor provider that maybe, you know, has gone cut corners on price to try and win that contract, there's going to be a significant risk.
I mean, to be fair, the bus operators are heavily selected on the basis of price, but I think the difference is that TfL is very clear what product it wants from the bus network. So it's, can you deliver this? Now, to be fair, the dock tender probably is quite prescriptive as to what they want. But in terms of dockless e-bikes, the current free floating product, cities typically don't have that same level of clarity as to what they want to achieve.
Correct.
But of course, it comes back to this problem we talked about earlier. There's a chicken and egg here as well, because if you want to fulfill the maximum social potential of micromobility, you're probably talking about a first mile, last mile solution, which is potentially transformative. Because if you live in a suburb, which is relatively low density housing, you're a mile or two from the nearest railway station or tube station. You're not going to walk that. You're going to get in your car and drive it. You get in your car and driving, well, you might as well just drive to where you're going. And it reinforces the existing dominance of cars in outer suburbs. Whereas if you can get an e-bike to the station, which is a bit of exercise, but it's good fun and it's easy. But of course, those suburbs aren't going to be redesigned around active travel until people are using active travel. And people aren't going to use active travel until there's a solution that enables them to do it. And the transport authority isn't going to tender an active travel service until they're confident that there's users for it. And so you just go round and round in that vicious circle, which is really hard to get out of.
Yeah. No, very much so. And, you know, I think that's where, I guess, you know, the business models are where we're seeing kind of, you know, subscription or bike leasing, whether that be directly to consumer or to business, will support helping that model. The reality is what we will look back on, in my opinion, going back to your question of what good looks like, 5-10 years, there'll be a combination, right? You'll either own a bike, you'll subscribe to a bike, or you'll use shared bike. So you've got, you know, share, subscription and hire. And there'll be a consolidation that fit, depending on where you are located, what you use it for, that will kind of enable to fit that model. But it'll be the private companies that will drive the change. So they'll be the ones that ultimately prove, you know, come in and say there is evident need here. Like you said, in the suburbs, we have people coming in and they're subscribing to a bike and they're using it this way, and that's what we kind of see. Or there's a bike library or whatever we want to call it, or a mobility hub, And that's where we will start seeing that transition from private to public. The frustrating thing is everyone knows it's there. Everyone knows the need exists. But like you say, public money won't invest on an idea or a probable. It has to, you know, or a possible. It has to be a probable.
And of course, we have to remember, we are only 6 years from when Horace Didier coined the term micromobility. And it was the case that when buses were first created, they were private businesses and they all chased down the same corridor. And when railways were first launched, they were private businesses and they all focused on the most lucrative corridors. And then gradually we have evolved into a world of regulation and these things being determined by the centre.
Well, that's the other problem, right? The term micromobility is 6 years old, but the active use of using a two-wheeled, you know, a frame and two wheels, whether electrified or non-electrified, to get around in a shared format has been around for 60 years. So this is the kind of other frustration is we have lots of learnings over the last 60 years from Dutch bike share, but then we classify micromobility as a new mode and all it is doing is making the same mistakes that were made over the last 60 years. So we're kind of saying just because it's a new form factor, which in some cases of the e-bike, it's not, it just means that it's not parked in a station, that it's 6 years old. It's not. You know, shared micromobility, if we're going to classify the two term of a micro vehicle being generally two wheels, but you know, either human propulsion or electric propulsion and a frame, has been around for 60 years.
And indeed, not just not learning the lessons, but sometimes learning the wrong lessons. I mean, I live in Waltham Forest, which in many ways is a fantastic borough for active travel. It's famous for it. But like a lot of places, hit very hard by the wave of Chinese dockless bikes in the twins, really had their fingers burnt. Waltham Forest Council will now not allow any dockless e-bikes into the borough at all. I kind of get why, but equally, instead of defining a proposition that works, which I think it has enormous potential to do for first mile, last mile, and the infrastructure in terms of the bike lanes, the low traffic neighbourhoods are all in place here, it's just locked out, which is really frustrating.
And that's a very UK-specific model. People always say, you're based in the UK, why do you not do any business in the UK? You know, why have we got no launches? It's because the UK took the burning they got from Ofi and Mobike so much more seriously than anywhere else did. You know, everyone else saw, okay, you know, you go anywhere else in the world, especially in Europe, and you say, okay, well, you know, Ofi and Mobike had pins in the map across the entirety of Europe at the similar sort of scale that we saw in the UK. But they, what they looked at it is and said, okay, well, that model doesn't work. But actually, what model does? The UK, you know, the UK instead of said, and don't get me wrong, there's better budget, there's better funding, there's better kind of investment in that, especially in kind of France. But you know, it's kind of, this is kind of the thing we always end up is the UK is using something that happened over a decade ago or coming up to a decade ago is still as the reason why we can't, rather than saying, well, look, if we were to fail with any other project, let's not even call it an active transport project, what would we do? We'd go back and say, well, what went well and what went wrong and how can we improve it? Whereas we've kind of taken a severe, can't do that. You know, it's the same with the announcement on the electric bikes on the tube and on the TfL transport that was made a few days ago. It's crazy. You know, like the UK market is incredulous. It's just, it blows my mind. I mean,
this is the banning of e-bikes from the underground.
Exactly. Even, you know, and it's kind of, you look at it in a broader scale. We are trying to hit 2030, 2040, 2050 sustainability targets, as is the rest of the world. That happens at municipal, regional and country level. We invested billions of pounds into HS2, which didn't materialize, still hasn't materialized, and has been kind of what the, you know, the grand idea has kind of been chopped off at the knees, hasn't happened. Active transport budget continues to be cut. And we're left in this situation where, okay, well, how do we move this? All right. You know, we did some nice business thing about making it cheap and easy to get an electric car. But if I want to get to, I live an hour, you know, 90 miles north of London, it takes me an hour to get directly into St. Pancras. If I want to do that, it costs me £120. And that's if I book in advance. That's the same amount as it costs me to get an annual pass for the Boris bikes in London. It's ridiculous.
Right. Let's pause on that cheerful, optimistic note and take a quick break, and then I want to come back and talk about some less.
Yep.
The reason for the break is so I can tell you, my listener, a bit about freewheeling the business as opposed to freewheeling the podcast. In a world which demands ever faster change, it can sometimes feel hard to make that happen. I help transport and mobility organisations innovate, solve challenges, and achieve faster results. that sounds like something you're interested in, visit www.freewheeling.com. Right, Tom Nutley. So we've talked about why it's not really working and why micromobility, the phrase you don't like, is not delivering its potential at the moment. And there's so much social promise and so much ability to influence the climate crisis, which is not there. One of the things that it strikes me is the root cause of all this is the fact that transport innovation at the moment comes out of Silicon Valley and is designed around Silicon Valley. And actually, if you are networks of very low density business parks with lots of space, free floating e-bikes is probably not a bad idea. You know, lots of workers, but lots of space around it. And it was a bit like when we had the demand responsive buses, which again were clearly designed around a Silicon Valley vision of how shared transport could work. And the needs of Europe are very different, but Europe isn't, if it's creating the ideas, it's not able to fund them, it's not able to scale them. And even the Europeans therefore end up replicating ideas that come out of Silicon Valley. Have you had the same thought? And have you any ideas as to how we can, to coin a phrase, take back control?
It's not necessarily something I agree with.
Tell me why.
It comes back to my main point, right? People call it micromobility and all they think about is scooters, right? So a bike hasn't been taken from Silicon Valley and brought to Europe. If anything, you know, it's the other way around. The bike culture is very much driven by Europe. And we're pushing very hard and trying very hard to try and get America to follow suit. But it's very hard because car centricity is a much worse state than it is here. For scooters, of course, it flips on its head. But if we're classifying the industry as a whole, then I would say Europe is very much taking what systems did people in the US come over and look at to kind of drive out bike share? London, Paris. Wasn't us going to New York and saying, oh, the city bike scheme, because it didn't exist. And if actually, you know, if anywhere, if we're being honest, in North America that drove that forward, it would actually be Canada, not Silicon Valley. Yes, for scooters, but why? Why does it make sense that, you know, it came? Well, again, it comes back to the point. It's easier to move someone to a vehicle that doesn't require, you know, that is throttle controlled in the US where you're either, you know, and I don't want to make a generalistic statement, but you're either active or you're not active. Car centricity is huge, especially outside of California, I guess California and certain other places. So if we're going to talk Silicon Valley to Europe and vice versa, I would challenge that it's not necessarily the vertical, it's the form factor that's been driven that way. And if anyone has driven cycling and bike share more, it's Europe by country mile.
Let me make an attempt to convince you and see where I get to with this.
Yeah, so of course.
I think my point, I agree with you entirely. The bike came from Europe. Indeed, the modern bike was invented by a chap from Walthamstow. Just a quick plug for Walthamstow there. But we in Europe had Velib and the Boris bike, and we had bike share schemes defined and designed by cities for cities and controlled and influenced by cities. And then what Silicon Valley did is take that model and say, well, actually, we're going to turn this. Yeah. What was the new technology? The new technology was electrification, and the new technology was geolocation. They're the kind of two things that got added to the bike that enables you to do something slightly different with it. But what Silicon Valley did was turn that into a highly individualistic mode in which you can go from anywhere to anywhere. Doesn't matter where it is. You're no longer a part of a transport network. It's an individual private business that's a profit-making entity in its own right, designed around revenue maximizing. It disconnected it from the city. Yep. Pumped vast amounts of money into it and then pasted that model into Europe.
Yeah, no, I agree. And why? Well, the original founders of Bird are all from Uber. You know, everyone, you know, the reason I believe that has happened is because the amount of money that was available in Silicon Valley and the ease that it was of former unicorn founders to try and take something and Uber-fy it was just too easy. You know, everyone quite, you know, you look at the valuations of 5-6 years ago on these businesses, it's ridiculous. You know, it's no one, everyone looks at it and says, yeah, cash was easy, but that's ridiculous.
It was ridiculous.
And, you know, I don't know whether it was kind of investors getting kind of a very big buzz of seeing, and, you know, you look, all that happened was they took what Ofo and Mobike did and they changed the form factor. So technically, you know, all they've done is saying, okay, well, that worked out of China and they managed to raise $6 billion. All right, cool. Scooters could be cooler. And again, the electrification. But people just saw the next Uber. Uber saw it. Uber bought Jump, you know, Lyft bought Motivate and PBSC. the investments were keen. But the reality was no one was ever buying into a, and you're right, I totally agree with you. No one was ever buying into a form factor or an industry vertical. People were buying into the network effect and thinking that this was going to be the next Uber, and if I don't get a hold of this. What they didn't realize is, you know, what Uber is a brand. Uber is a software company. Anyone that touches, anyone that is currently is in bikes and scooters is a hardware company. And it completely broke the model.
Yeah.
Which is why 100%. Uber got out quickly from Jump. Lyft made a complete swerve and went with Dox providers. And we saw no, you know, even now Bolt are obviously moving up to IPO. They've made some, you know, strategic investments, especially in the last few weeks. And there was a rumor they were going to buy Tier. Why haven't they? Because they know that micromobility is just a tick box that helps their IPO price. It's not about.
I was raising money in the VC markets. I ran a startup before I joined TFL, and I was raising money in the VC markets during this early phase of this boom, and it was absolutely fascinating. And you really saw that culture play out. I mean, my first ever ride on an e-scooter was absolutely terrifying because I was in a VC's office. I pitched Snap, which was a marketplace platform for coach travel, which I felt should be more attractive to them because it was capital light. All we were doing was connecting users to operators who otherwise would have no access to that consumer market, exactly the kind of thing that they'd want. Yeah. Buying lots of e-scooters, owning them, maintaining them, felt far worse for their business model. But already you could see in the US, this was starting to take off, and there was that kind of herd mentality. Exactly. And so this one VC I pitched said, no, we've already done our mobility investment, and we haven't announced it yet, but we're investing in these. And he pulled an e-scooter out of his cupboard and said, here you go, have a ride on that. And I got on this thing and squeezed the handle, and it started to go. And then I realized that my brain hadn't associated the fact that I'd squeezed the handle with the fact that it had started to go. I hadn't made that connection. And I therefore didn't know how to stop the damn thing. I was accelerating towards the glass wall at the end of the office. I thought, this is going to be the moment. I will die here. I will die scooting through a glass wall of an office in a VC who's just rejected my pitch. This is not the way to go. I then shouted, how do I stop the thing? He said, let go. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, fine. So
that makes sense.
I lived another day.
And, you know, you're right. Like, you know, people is herd mentality. You see, you know, Andreessen Horowitz, you see, you know, the other big funds start investing in something. Everyone in Europe was like, oh, I've got something. And that's the other thing that has made it so hard. You know, you go back to your question, and this is kind of a point that maybe I haven't thought about, is that boom has now made it near on impossible for startups in the micromobility that coin themselves as micromobility ecosystem that have fantastic ideas, products, solutions, platforms, and made it nigh on impossible for them to scale because no one is willing to touch micromobility with a barge pole. Because again, going back to what you were saying about, you know, the boroughs in London being burnt by Ofo and Mobike, they've been burnt so hard by investing a significant amount of capital into a buzz. You know, it literally was just like, oh, micromobility is a buzzword, let's chuck money at it. It was like AI before, you know, when you go back 10, 15 years ago.
All right,
that's hard.
Let's wrap up. So I want to give you a chance now. I know for absolute certainty that lots of public transport authorities listen to this podcast. I don't know if micromobility operators do, but I know other transport operators do because I've spoken to them. So Let me give you a metaphorical microphone or megaphone. What would you say, first of all, to the public transport authorities of cities and of countries? What's your message to them about this market?
Remember what your purpose is. That's the key thing, right? Is what are we here to be, you know, what are we here to achieve, and what's the end, you know, the end outcome or the that we want to make, and then work backwards from there. Because the problem we have at the moment is we're knee-jerking, no different to what we're saying about the operators, no different to what we're saying about the VCs. We're knee-jerking as a response based upon all of this other fluff that sits around it. Think about what we're trying to achieve when it comes to the cities of the future, to the active travel future, and think about how an e-bike or an e-scooter or whatever micromobility mode that may be, whichever business model that may be or infrastructure model, and think, how does that fit into my town, city, county, country? That, for me, that's the easiest way. If you think long-term and work backwards, because the struggle that cities will always have is they're so far behind the innovation curve. And that gap, you know, that delta is only going to increase over the coming years, months, years, and decades.
Okay, now imagine you're talking to what one might call a legacy transport operator, you know, a network rail or a bus operator, yeah, or someone who runs the existing public transport network. What would you say to them about this market?
Think about integration. These aren't cannibalizing your, you know, micromobility isn't cannibalizing rides. What they're doing is enabling more and more people to become aware that maybe wouldn't have used that service before and make them use them longer, further and better because they have a direct connect to the end location they go. You know, legacy transports are on a fixed end-to-end point, right? What micromobility allows them to do is create an ecosystem that opens up locations around their stations or locations a lot better than any other provider would. And it's not a car. It also means you can reduce your car parking spaces, yada, yada, yada. You know, the benefits are profound by integrating, whether that is in terms of physical infrastructure, providing parking, charging at that location, or software integration with their application. If I can go on to network rail and jump on and go, okay, cool, I can book my bike as soon as I arrive in the station, fantastic. It makes my, you know, my user experience so much easier and go from there.
Finally, the micromobility operators themselves, what would you say to them?
Stop racing to the bottom. You know, just because a RFI or an RFP or a license says it needs to have this, if we don't have it, don't say you do, and don't drop prices just to win a contract to put another pin in the map. As in, for us to move forward as an industry, we need to be aligned on what good looks like and make sure we stick to it, even if it means a lot. You know, if you just because you're losing war, it's like we need to be happy to lose a battle to win the war. But as soon as we apply for an RFI that is ridiculous, we're condoning that action. So that would be mine. Stop racing to the bottom.
Fantastic. Tom Nutley, thank you so much from Urban Sharing. Thank you so much for joining me on the Freewheeling Podcast.
Thank you, Thomas. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Freewheeling Podcast. Thank you so much to Tom Nutley of Urban Sharing for joining me, and thank you so much to you for joining me as well. Now, is there anyone else who you think would enjoy the Freewheeling Podcast? Because if there is, why not drop them a link to this episode? Then they can discover it and join in the conversations that we're having as well.